From your taxes to health care to public pensions, public policy affects almost every aspect of our lives. Good morning. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and welcome to Policy Matters, WJCT's quarterly radio program that takes a close look at public policy issues that matter to you. First Coast Connect and Melissa Ross will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you all for being with us. Today, we're very excited. We're going to be talking about water, the politics and challenges facing us all with regard to water. Many consider water to be the next oil. Some say future wars will be fought over water, and others are concerned about a permanent future drought. We are very pleased on today's program to have two nationally renowned experts on water policy and marine life. One comes to us from San Francisco, James Workman. He is a nationally renowned journalist, foreign correspondent, and author who is brought to us courtesy of the World Affairs Council, and he'll be giving presentations today at Jacksonville University and the University of North Florida. And the other is Dr. Quint White, the founding executive director of the Marine Science Research Institute at Jacksonville University. We're very pleased to have both on today's program. We'll also be taking your questions and comments. If you would like to join today's conversation, please give us a call at 549-2937. If you'd like to join the conversation today on water policy and the politics of water, give us a call at 549-2937. Thank you both for being on today's program. And Mr. Workman, I want to start with you. I think it was pretty timely, actually. The Pope this weekend, Pope Francis, spoke out about the need to, and encourage the world, in fact, to ensure that its water supplies are protected and available to all. And he said, and I quote from him, that water was the most essential element for life. And he said, quote, humanity's future depends on our ability to care for it and share it. He then went on to encourage governments to ensure that water supplies are protected and accessible to all. So my question is, do we have currently, and is there a looming water crisis globally?
I just have so much respect for Pope Francis as a spiritual leader, not just now, but for all time. And I think he brings us closer to this idea of a water ethic, that it's a moral issue. It's an ethical issue. It gets to our values of how we relate to each other and to the natural world. St. Francis, who he was named after. We do have a global water crisis. It's a combination of local crises that add up through trade and conflict and the transboundary rivers into a transnational water conflict. But what he gets at in particular at the end, that we need to share and care for water. Sharing is hard. It's always been hard for humans in our nature. We can share something that belongs to us, but you can't share what's not yours. And that's where I think the crux of the matter is, that you need to have some kind of sense of dominion, some long-term sense of ownership, either in a legal or a spiritual sense, before you can share and feel a sense of stewardship to care for a resource as precious as water.
Well, let me shift, talk a little bit about, from the global crisis, to turn to Dr. White to talk a little bit about where we may be here in Florida or even, in fact, Jacksonville. But if you'd like to join today's conversation as we discuss the water supply, the looming water crisis, and challenges we're facing here in North Florida and throughout the state, give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. Dr. White, you're the founding director and locally considered the guy to go to with respect to marine life and water issues. What about this whole concept of this water crisis here in the region and in the state of Florida?
Well, we do have a water crisis, and I think one of the bigger problems is that people really don't understand it and don't know it. And it's a perception problem, because right now we can turn on a faucet and get the water we need. And we're unlike millions and millions of people, billions of people in the world who spend hours a day getting water. You know, we can get up in the morning and turn on a hot shower and take a long hot shower and not think twice about it. Our water has been good, has been plentiful, and been cheap for a long time. And it's not that we're going to run out of water. We're not going to run out of water, but we're going to run out of cheap, clean water if we're not careful.
Well, your point is one that we have a caller on the line who I think wants to talk about that very point. Daryl, welcome to the program, and I think you have a comment or a question for either Mr. Workman or Dr. White with regard to the water shortage. Daryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think that there is a huge water shortage throughout the rest of the world, but here in northern Florida, I find it ironic that an inch of rain will fall in Northeast Florida today while you're talking about this. All of it will be fall on the roofs, on the parking lots. It will be drained into the ditch, and then it will be put into the ocean. We don't have a wattage shortage. We have a collection problem. Why are we not simply collecting the water before it becomes salt water? That seems to be the problem in Northeast Florida. We're paving over our aquifer and then pumping out of it and then dumping the water that would go into the aquifer into the ocean. And I find that to be, we spend billions of dollars on our roads to get rid of the water, but now we have a water shortage. Doesn't that seem strange?
Daryl, thank you very much for your question. Dr. White, would you like to address Daryl's question?
He's exactly right. And part of that is that perception idea. We see all this rain. We have about 53, 54 inches of rainfall in Duval County. What's interesting is that in Duval County, because of our geology, none of that water that hits the roofs and ground or anything else goes into the aquifer. We have an area that doesn't allow that water to go in. It's only south and north of us and west of us that water actually will penetrate into the aquifer. So the water that falls on Duval County basically does run onto the ocean. But again, we've got a perception problem. Most people don't want to drink rainwater. And so it's not that we don't have enough water. We just don't have enough cheap drinkable water.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, you're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT 89.9 FM. We're at 549-2937, 549-2937. And Mr. Workman, I want to point to an illustration of this problem, something, of course, that you wrote a nationally acclaimed book on, Heart of Dryness. And it dealt with, of course, your experience working in Africa, in the Kalahari, and the approach of the government of Botswana. How about describing for our listeners your experience there, how this book came about, and how this relates to today's conversation?
Sure. Well, I was arriving in Southern Africa to look at this question. Are there going to be water wars? Are people going to be killing each other over water? And Southern Africa is a great place to look at that because it's an arid landscape with a huge booming population and not many physical and institutional resources. And as I arrived there, the government of Botswana, an otherwise wonderful democratic, transparent, non-corrupt country, cut off the water to the Bushmen, who have been living in the Kalahari for about 30,000 years. And so I said, "Oh, this is terrible. I've got to go, help these poor, helpless people," and rushed out with Land Rover full of food and water to save them. And of course, I broke down, and on the way, realized how dumb I was, that these guys knew something about surviving and thriving in the desert with very little water. And that, when I finally did get out of there and caught up with them and found them, they were showing me a new approach to water that we don't have. And it gets at the last caller's question about we have a collection problem. The Bushmen knew where to find water, even when there wasn't a river flowing by. They knew it was embedded in the plants, in the animals they hunted, trapped in little crooks of trees and rocks. And so they gathered that. And when they gathered the water resources, they owned the water resources. And that led to the famous, Adam Smith, truck, barter, and exchange system that they'd been practicing for 30,000 years. So whatever they didn't need personally, they could bring back to the camp and exchange with others. And this turned, conflict into cooperation. It turned scarcity into abundance. It created incentives to find more water in more diverse locations. And it brought stability there. And it was a big awakening for me because I'd sort of thought, oh, the Bushmen, they're just amazing people. They all just share and sort of have this Marxist mentality. And they're just as, selfish and lustful as any of us. But what they have is a coping mechanism that lets them thrive in a place with very little water. I mean, we complain if we have to go below 200 gallons a day. They're living comfortably on 1 or 2 gallons a day.
Well, we have a number of people who are calling, and so give a chance to go to the phone lines. Bob, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Do you have a question?
Mister, I have a comment. I'm with the Florida Springs Institute, the advisory board, and I wanted to make the listeners aware of a project that we have in for Amendment 1 funding that would buy land to create artificial wetlands to receive semi-purified wastewater from JEA. And re-inject it back into, after it's purified by the wetlands, re-inject it back into the aquifer. This would this would constrict the big cone of depression that everyone's talking about from about 65 miles all the way over to Keystone Heights, down to about 42 miles.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for your comment. And Quint, maybe you could like to comment on Bob's comment.
Oh, I think it's a great idea. One of the problems we've had is that we've paved over so many areas and we've destroyed our wetlands. And so as we go back and try to let nature take its normal course and move that water around, part of the problem becomes perhaps an energy conservation issue too, because my understanding is that part of the system that's being designed will require energy because you've got to sort of pump that water uphill, if you would. So it's a very complex situation in which these things are all sort of interrelated, and I'm not sure that's something we always appreciate.
Oh, that interrelation is something we can get to later in our program. Very big topic, but we have lots and lots of callers. So let me, right now, I'd like to go to Curtis, who's waiting online with a question for either Dr. White or Mr. Workman. Curtis, welcome to today's program on Policy Matters.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. My comment is, it's hard to take this water shortage serious when on any given rainy day, you can drive past malls, shopping centers, and see the water going, or drive past some of the big buildings with beautiful landscape and see their water still running, even when it's raining or storming. Then my concern is the golf courses. They got the most beautiful grass everywhere, but yet still it takes water. No one is addressing those issues. Thank you.
Well, Curtis, thank you for your comment. And I think Curtis makes a really good point, Dr. White. I mean, you talked about the heart of dryness. Maybe this goes a little bit to the heart problem. this whole notion of hard to take it seriously, at least when your common sense tells you or your eyes tell you that we're either being pretty wasteful or there seems to be plenty of water. Dr. White, any comment?
Exactly. I mean, I agree with him. It is. You look at it and you go, wait a minute, where's all this water going to? What's happening? And, we're not very efficient in our water use. And I think that's something we're going to have to start paying for at some point in time. I think a lot of people don't sort of realize that when they turn on that tap and draw out drinking water, they're not paying for the water. They're paying for the distribution system for that water and what cleaning we do for it, the treatment, and getting it to your house is what you're paying for. You're not actually paying for the water per se. That may change in the near future.
Mr. Workman, let me shift a little bit. I know that the caller makes a good point about your common sense as you drive down the street, you see the water, but let's take a little broader perspective. With a growing population now at 7 billion, a growing global population, with the greater industrialization in the developing worlds, and with increased pollution, clearly there are pressures on the water supply. And in fact, by some accounts, more people die due to inadequate water supply than everything else combined. So how about commenting on a little bit broader scale as to the nature of this challenge when it comes to the water supply?
There's physical water scarcity, and then there's economic water scarcity. And when you're talking about the 700 million people who lack enough water, enough safe water to drink, the people who, as children, babies, die of dehydration from diarrhea, it's a horrible, horrible, and it's a preventable problem. And there's a lot of institutions that are set up for this. And 10 years ago, when I'd started going to these global forums, that was the issue. It's like, how do we help these poor people? What we're also facing now, though, is this physical limit. We have hit the cap on how much water can be withdrawn from the earth. And there's the same amount of water that's always been here since the dinosaurs, since the Romans. But as you said, there's more people using it for more things and more ways, and it's being transferred from places where there's very little water to places where there actually is plenty of water. When I was thinking of what the Pope said, my confession is I took a longer and hotter shower today than I should have. I drank a coffee that was probably grown in a place like Guatemala that has a water scarcity problem. So I was taking water away from these places. I like cherry tomatoes in the winter, and I see that they're grown in Israel. And I know that's taken water out of the aquifer, out of the Jordan River, that is exacerbating the problem there. And so what the last caller, what Curtis pointed out, is that water may be, priceless in this spiritual sense, but we treat it as worthless in an economic sense.
Well, we have lots and lots of phone calls, so let's go to the phone lines. Evan, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Do you have a question or comment?
Thank you so much. I actually just had a comment. I feel like in a conversation about water scarcity or future water scarcity even, it's really worth it to bring up hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Because that's something that we've seen really ruin a lot of states' local water supply. In some really extreme cases, there's even been flammable tap water. So I was just wondering if maybe you guys would like to comment on fracking and how we could, that's one preventative measure we could take. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. That's, Dr. White, very good question. Any comments on the fracking and the recent trend in fracking?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have a tendency to think that we can solve problems through engineering, and fracking is probably a good example of that. The other problem is that it's out of sight, out of mind. And so fracking is one of those things that happens down in the earth, and you inject things into the earth in order to free up gas and oil. And with that comes consequences. And sometimes the consequences aren't immediate. They take time to develop, and so the connection is not immediately drawn. Going back to this idea of perception of water, it's the ability to get, you know, cheap, good, drinkable water, and now we want the same thing for our oil supply and our energy supply. And we think, oh, this fracking is a great idea. We'll get all this extra gas and oil out of the water, out of the land, but it takes water. It takes chemicals. And that, in turn, impacts other things that we didn't necessarily think were going to happen before. So the call is exactly right. We've got to be more conscious of how we're treating this earth. There's a certain stewardship of natural resources that we've sort of taken for granted because we've had so much for so long, we just think we're going to have it forever. And there are some people that are perhaps smarter than I am that are beginning to say, you know, we've got to be careful because we cannot continue to have the population growth and the use of the natural resources and have it be sustainable for the long haul.
Is this a good example of something that you've been teaching me about, and that is sort of the interconnectedness of these problems, in that sometimes in an attempt to solve one problem, you create another, or the unintended consequences or the unforeseen consequences of a technology solution that seems like a savior on the one hand, but then you realize the consequences, there may be more to it in terms of what the consequences are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the world is full of those kinds of examples. We do one thing and then think, oh, my gosh, what happened there? I didn't really mean for that to happen. You know, we were trying to save lives, and yet we create flooding problems because of the way we dammed up rivers and things like that. And so, you know, the world is full of examples of things that happened that we thought, oh, I didn't realize that was connected. And water is at the nexus of so many things. It's that focal point that I've been using an example I've heard a few weeks ago in which the speaker was talking about had drawn four boxes, and they were culture in one box, the environment in another box, the economy in another box, and energy in a fourth box. And you can almost continue to add boxes with a variety of names on them. And then the particular author had driven an infinite loop between all of these boxes and then said, what's at the nexus? What's the crossroads of all four of these boxes? And it's water, because water becomes, it's essential for culture, it's essential for the environment, it's essential for energy, and it's essential for the economy, and yet we take it for granted.
Well, you're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT 89.9 FM, and our phone lines are really lit up, so we're going to go to some of our callers. Jay, I'd like to welcome you to the program, and thank you for joining us. Do you have a question for Mr. Workman or Dr. White? Hello, Jay? Or is this Barbara? Excuse me.
Barbara,
excuse me. Yeah. Jay will be on in just a minute. I'm going to Jay in just a minute, but it was Barbara.
Hi. Good morning. One of you guys made a comment about rainwater, that nobody wants to drink rainwater, but nobody wants to drink it because it's polluted. And yet, many of us gardeners will collect rainwater and use it to water our plants. And I often wonder what I'm pouring into my plants from the rainwater we collected. And your topic is timely, because just this week I was commenting to my husband that I thought we wasted a lot of water when we turn our shower on and wait for it to get warm. And so we just this week decided to get a bucket and start putting that in the tub to collect that warm water and then use that to water our plants, to pour in the cat's dish, and so forth.
Barbara, we need more people like you. We got a steward on the phone. We got a steward for the for natural resources on the phone.
Well, I just was telling my husband, I said, we spend a lot of money each month paying our water bill, and how much of it are we wasting? But in addition to that, I learned from another gardener that The problem with rainwater when you have when you're collecting it outside, unless you have closed containers, is that it attracts mosquitoes. And we learned from another gardener to put fish in the barrel and small fish, guppy-sized fish, and then put some water water plants on top of that to feed them, and that helps fight the mosquitoes. So that's what we've been doing. But I would like for you to address the issue of why can't we drink rainwater? What can we as individuals do to clean our rainwater to make it usable to drink?
Barbara, thank you very much both for your stewardship and for your question. Dr. White?
Well, I think you're bringing up a great point. I happen to have rain barrels at my house, and mine are happen to be enclosed, and so when I do get, I collect that rainwater and use it in my garden. My wife and I also do the bucket, not in the shower so much. I haven't gotten that aggressive, but we have a pitcher by the kitchen sink that we fill up when we're waiting for the hot water to get, and then we use that to water plants around the house and outside and what have you. The problem, and I should comment too, that the drinking water from the rainwater is more of a perception problem again. You can purify that water through filtration and heating and chemicals. Filtration will do a very good job on it and drink it. It's a perception problem. The sort of what they call the yuck factor. And yet there are municipalities in the United States that are using part of their wastewater to, in fact, supplement their drinking water. At the Marine Science Research Institute at JU, which is a leadership in energy and environmental design gold certified building, we actually collect rainwater and use that to flush toilets, to do boat washdown, and to do irrigation. And it's sort of fun to watch that usage and how it changes over time. But there's a lot of things we can do. But because water has been so cheap, people don't want to take the time and energy to do those little steps because they don't think it's worth it.
And it also leads to what Barbara talked about, sort of the wasteful practices. I bet every one of us, if you were to take a hard, objective look, could see all kinds of practices that involved a lot of waste.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because one of the things that's happened in the United States, and actually I suspect worldwide, but I know more, I've seen more data for the United States, is that we've watched our water consumption drop on a per capita basis. We've also watched our electric consumption drop, our energy consumption. This ends up actually having here we go back to our unintended consequences concept again, because as I mentioned before, we don't pay for water. We're paying for the distribution of that water. So we priced our water and the cost of getting that water out into the homes based on a consumption model. Well, as we consume less, then it means that the cost per unit of water is actually going to go up. And that's, again, counterintuitive to people. Say, wait a minute, I'm using less water, but I'm paying more. That doesn't make any sense. You're seeing the same thing with energy. Because we've been very successful in reducing our energy dependence by LED lights and high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems, we're starting to use less energy per capita. That's causing problems with utilities because, again, their model for paying for all this has been based on consumption.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT 89.9 FM, and we have some very patient callers on the line who've been holding quite a while. So I want to go to Vern, and thanks, Vern, for the patience. I know you've been waiting for a while, and we appreciate your welcome to the program. We'd appreciate your comment or question.
Vern, am I on there?
Yes, you are, Vern. I know you've been waiting a while. Thank you for being so patient.
All right, no problem. I wonder if we can comment on the whole concept of desalinization. Keeping in mind, of course, it might not apply to the entire U.S. of A., but it certainly applies to Florida. And also keeping in mind that the history of technology, wherever it is that it starts high at cost and that as it's used, it's worked down into a more manageable realm. So how do we stand with that?
Vern, thank you for your comment. Mr. Workman, I'd like to turn to you, and that is a big topic. And often in the public, that topic is brought out. How about commenting on desalinization?
Yeah, desalinization or desalination, whatever you want to call it, it's a tool in the toolkit, but I think it should be taken with a proverbial grain of salt. It can help cities like Tampa. It can help cities like Riyadh or San Diego, Melbourne and Sydney, Australia, that have a lot of wealth, that have a lot of capital to pay for that in the first place. But it is an extremely, you know, environmentally painful choice. It increases the chemicals and the salt content nearby in the waters, in many ways sterilizing it, and it's puts up a lot of carbon into the air. The bigger problem is that it doesn't get at the fundamental question of whose water is it and how can it be used efficiently. Saudi Arabia is the biggest user of desalination, and they pump all this water from the coasts through about, I think, 27 different plants to Riyadh, where they use as much as we do in Florida or California. And so they're living in this false sense of comfort in the middle of a desert, and that desalination goes to the food as well as their lifestyles. What Saudi Arabia is essentially doing, and this still blows me away, they're burning up $14 worth of oil to create a cubic meter, 1,000 liters of water, that they then sell for 3 cents. And that is just, it's a way of sort of a political bringing stability, but it is very wasteful and very distortion. It makes the country more vulnerable than it needs to be in the long term. The question then, as Barbara may have asked, is like, well, how do you pay for this? How do you get water to reflect its real value? And no, king of Saudi Arabia, no politician running for office here in Jacksonville is going to stand up and say, vote for me or keep me in office, and I'll make sure that water's more expensive for everybody. I'll make sure food's more expensive for everybody, and I'll make sure energy's more expensive.
I just want to note, today is Election Day in Jacksonville, and that has not been the platform of anybody. I just wanted to mention that.
Oddly enough.
Go ahead, Doug. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, and so desalination, there's costs. There's those hidden costs that Dr. White got at. It may produce some water for some cities, but it's destroying a lot of life in the ocean. It's destroying a lot of stability in the atmosphere as a consequence, and we're going to pay the price for that.
Well, Rick, I want to welcome you to the program. We have lots of callers. I also want to thank you for your patience, and welcome to the program, Rick. Hello, Rick. I think Rick has been waiting here for a while. We'll put him back on hold, and we'll go to Jay, who's also been very patient. Jay, welcome to the program. I mentioned your name earlier. We're glad to have you on the program. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. A lot of people don't think about the water we waste in our toilets, but it's a huge volume of water that's flushed away every day. Are there any, technology things that we can do, or even some legislation that we can push for that would increase the use of high-efficiency toilets, or even maybe transition away from using water to remove waste from our homes?
Jay, thank you very much for your question. Mr. Workman?
It's funny you ask that, because when I was with the Bushmen in the Kalahari, they wanted to know about my day and how we use water and how things are. And they say, wait, let me understand. I was working with them through translators. Let me get this straight. You go out, you gather all this rainwater and rivers and pump it up from the ground. You treat it really to a high drinking water quality. You put it in your toilet, and then you defecate and urinate in it, and then send it away to be treated. Who's the advanced civilization here? Where's the sophistication coming from? And it's part of every culture says we want to make people not think about water. We want to make that water problems go away. And a toilet is a perfect example of that. But there are. Going beyond high-efficiency toilets, there's urine diversion toilets that are being marketed in through the Gates Foundation because water and sanitation are very closely aligned. And this is helping prevent disease and bringing down costs of energy and water around the world. I think what you're getting at is then how do you make this sort of a status symbol as it is in some parts of Europe where you say, yes, let me show you my composting toilet. Let me show you my a waterless toilet, and that represents a third to in some cases half of the water that households and businesses can use. So there are some incentives, but you still got to get at that underlying driver of what's water worth and who owns it.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a comment or a question for Mr. Workman or Dr. White, please give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. We are talking about water, the water supply, water scarcity globally and here regionally. We have a number of people online, but if you'd like to join us, give us a call at 549-2937. 1-800-237-3737. And Rick, we're going to thank you for your patience. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I don't know why you didn't hear me before. I was just a quick question about, I understand in 18th century ships would not have to come ashore for fresh water. They would just park over a spring off the coast. And there was a Florida former legislator that wanted to pipe water from Cocoa Beach down to Dade County off the coast. I was just wondering about if there's anything done to seal up these springs or collect the water that goes into the ocean from the aquifer.
Well, what you're talking about is there is a spring off of St. Augustine, off of Crescent Beach, several miles. What's interesting, I got the Jacksonville in 1976, and back in the late 70s, went out there with some friends of mine, and we looked at it, and you could literally see the water coming to the surface. Didn't really taste it at the time, but it was reported to be relatively fresh water. Well, one of the consequences of the water withdrawal we've seen from the aquifer is that now that water doesn't flow out quite the same rate that it used to. You really cannot go offshore and see it. It's still there. Claude Kirk, in fact, wanted to build a pipeline system and tap into that water and pump it ashore. And that's always been sort of our solution to a lot of these problems is, if there's more water someplace, let's pipe it over here. Well, that piping costs money, and the energy costs money. And so I think that's sort of where we are. There has been a lot of work done in capping off what's called artesian wells, which is where people put pipes into the aquifer, and there was so much pressure, the water just flowed automatically. And I think the Water Management District's done a pretty good job, even though there are a few left around, of capping off these artesian wells so you don't just have that water just flowing off into the ground for no use.
On today's program, Policy Matters, we are very pleased to have two renowned experts, Mr. Workman, who went to school at both Yale and Oxford and is a nationally renowned journalist, foreign correspondent, and author brought to us by the World Affairs Council. Like I said, he'll be making presentations today at Jacksonville University and the University of North Florida, and the founding director of the Marine Science Research Institute at Jacksonville University, Dr. Quentin White. If any of you would like to join the conversation or have a comment for us, give us a call at 549-2937. 549-2937, and we are going to go to Joe. Joe, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
2 points. One is on the desalination. Indeed, is very energy intensive, and the only way I see that working is to use nuclear power to do the desal. But then there's the effluent disposal, and I don't see a solution to that, particularly in areas that are not close to the ocean. But even in the ocean, it's creating a dead zone off of Tampa that isn't coming back. The other bigger point, though, is I think we need a cultural shift. You brought up watering lawns. Half of DEA's water goes to water lawns, and that's probably not a bad national figure for the amount of water that goes for green grass. If we can get away from this idea that we ought to have green lawns, it would be a huge step forward in our water management issues.
Joe, thank you very much for your question and comments. Dr. White?
I agree with Joe. I mean, we've got this fascination with beautiful green lawns. In fact, there was an interesting book written a few years ago called The Greening of America, which was this idea of fascination. Where do we get this idea that we've all got to have these luscious lawns? I have to admit that if I was a benevolent dictator, I would ban St. Augustine grass, but that's one of those things that won't come to be. I don't irrigate, and my yard looks like it sometimes, but the concept is that we currently use about half, if not a little bit more than half, of the water that's drinkable that comes out of our taps. We actually spray that onto our yards and use it outside the home. I was alarmed a few years ago to discover that the number one crop in the state of Florida is actually turf grass. And I'm not sure that says a whole lot about our advanced civilization.
Well, Mr. Workman, I have a question for you. The caller, Joe, makes a very good point. He's talking about the need for a cultural change. And your work globally, you spent many years in Africa, many years as an advisor around the world, really, advising governments on this whole challenge. And a lot of it comes back to something the caller talked about, and that is the cultural change in affecting behavior. What are your thoughts on how, both from a cultural standpoint, a public policy standpoint, we begin to create either incentives or other approaches to help shift the culture and change behavior?
That's a great question and great thing I have been wrestling with. I've been fascinated in the last few years with this rise of what's often called the share economy, of Airbnb, of Uber, of Lyft, of all these new businesses that are starting where people are able to turn their homes, their cars, their clothing, their closets, their storage rooms, their garages into something that they can rent out. And that creates a wonderful incentive for efficiency. It reduces demand for resources. It brings people closer together, and they're able to do that, you know, online and build trust and re-knit together what had been sort of fragmented communities. You can't do that right now with water, but I think we're getting there. And I think that is where a cultural shift can come. When if you have a ownership share of the water you save, as the Bushmen do, as Acequias do in the Southwest, as the Balinese water temples do in Indonesia, as some of the Omani farmers and cities do under Afflaj, if you had something like that here, then it would revolutionize both the culture and the efficiency and the politics of water in a wonderful, I think, direction where we wouldn't need a single new drop and where people would voluntarily be ripping out their lawns because they could then market or lease out the water that they've saved. I do feel that, you know, culture is a combination of spiritual ethics that the Pope referred to and, you know, self-interest where we say, okay, this is mine. I'm going to care about that. I'm going to be a steward of that because it's going to benefit me.
Well, thank you. Our phone lines are absolutely lit up. I want to thank our callers for their patience. Kate in Mandarin, welcome to the program, and thank you for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Kate.
I actually think my children and I have actually figured out the solution to this problem. We did it for a science project at Loretto Elementary. Why can't, for example, our family, we looked at our water bill, and we figured out that the three of us use 94% less water than the average three-person family in Jacksonville. We don't flush our toilets. We use our bath water to flush our toilets. We only flush when we have to. I do not water my lawn. Our dishwasher is always full when we run it. Same thing with our washing machine. And why can't we say this is what a person who actually is making an effort to conserve is doing? And if you want to use more than that, that's fine, but you will pay exponentially more for it on your water bill. And then we wouldn't have to talk about all these other things to do. People would take it seriously when they were paying $5 a gallon to put it on their lawn.
You know, Dr. White, Kate makes some really good points, and that is beginning to align the economics of being a steward with stewardship and changing behavior. She gives some great examples. Behavior tends to change with economic incentives. So what about Kate's comments?
Oh, I think she's exactly right. And I've been advocating a much steeper tiered water supply cost. In fact, I'm working with some local municipalities now on doing something along those lines. But part of my concept being we would price that what I call subsistence level of water, sort of a base level of water, very, very inexpensively, if not even give it away for free. And then, but then once you go above a reasonable amount, and we can debate that a little bit, then you start charging a whole lot more. And as you increase that number, you charge more and more and more. I think she's exactly right in terms of people's behavior. I have a lot of faith in people. I think we do what we have to do sometimes. And when we make, when it makes economic sense to us, we do the same thing. We don't do the extreme thing in terms of using our bath water to flush the toilets, but we do do a little bit of if it's yellow, let it mellow, if it's brown, it down kind of thing. And it's sort of interesting. And if you've got a small household and there's not a whole lot of things going on, it all works. And there are a lot of things we can do. And we've been able to water our lawns, I'm going to say excessively, because it was cheap and we didn't have to worry about the cost. But it's getting to the point we've got to worry about the cost. And it's not just the economic cost, it's the environmental cost.
We'd like to welcome Matt to the program. Thank you very much, Matt, for joining us. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I did. I actually had a couple. I don't want to take up too much time, but I mean, it just seems like in a culture where we would rather water our grass than, you know, maybe plant a garden in our front yard and have food, that we use it for things like fracking for oil. And I know that that's important for gas, but what I'm getting at is, basically, I wanted to ask your experts how much gas or how much water is actually used in the fracking process, and is that water ever going to be useful again? That's really future.
Matt, thank you very much for your question. Mr. Workman, he makes a very good question, and that is, and this also relates to Dr. White's earlier comment, which is you try to solve one problem, you may have created another. So how much water is used in the fracking process, and how about the relationship of those two?
Yeah, I'm never going to become a sort of apologist for the fracking industry, I don't think. There's too much mystery, too much opacity in terms of the chemicals that are used and their effect on the aquifers that we may never know. In terms of the quality. Ironic, fracking doesn't remove water, you know, bring it to the surface. And it does harm the quality, and I think and that's a huge danger. And there's also the methane leaks that are very troubling from fracking. But you can't just look at one of these in isolation. You can't say, okay, fracking is bad. You have to compare it to the whole spectrum of different energy sources. And if you set it next, and also in the context of where it's happening, if you set fracking next to ethanol we were talking about is this, you know, clean, renewable source of grains, of sugars, of soybeans that can be converted into fuel. And yet that destroys far, far more water than fracking ever will in terms of bringing it to the surface, sometimes mining fossil aquifers that water is gone from that place forever. It can't even be treated. And yet we are calling for, 5, 10, 15% increases in of ethanol fuel into the fuel mix worldwide. And that creates incredible stress on water everywhere, on farmers taking food out of the food chain in a hungry world and converting it into something we put in our gas tanks.
You know, Dr. White, Mr. Workman's comments highlight the theme that you've been talking about, which is just how challenging and difficult and how interrelated these problems are. You have a water problem or you have an energy problem, you turn to fracking, you turn to ethanol, you think you're solving one problem, but it has consequences. And any comments on sort of the unforeseen consequences, or sometimes maybe the consequences, your eyes are wide open, but we just accept those consequences because it's the better choice of two evils.
Well, I think we do that all the time. And it's fascinating from an academic point of view. You know, I enjoy the academic discussion and the debate. But at some point, we have to make decisions, and we have to make decisions as a society. And it can be hard because you're sort of pitting, gee whiz, do I want jobs or do I want clean water? Well, we may have to figure out a way to have both. A clean environment means a strong economy. And Lawton Childs made that point years ago. And I think we've got to sort of begin to adopt that idea as sort of our mantra. I think sometimes our political leaders stick their head in the sands because they don't want to admit there are problems because they don't want to scare away potential jobs. And yet no one wants to move to an area and then discover there's not enough water or the St. John's River turns green because of the nutrients that are running off into it. So they're hard decisions, but we need courageous political leadership, and we need our general population to tell our leaders what we want, because I'd say it like this: our leaders do what we ask them to do.
On today's program, we have two extraordinary leaders, two extraordinary experts, Mr. Workman, who's visiting Jacksonville from San Francisco, courtesy of the World Affairs Council, who received his undergraduate degree from Yale and studied at Yale and Oxford, and has been a nationally renowned journalist and author, and Dr. Quentin White, the founding director of the Marine Science Research Institute at Jacksonville University. You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT 89.9 FM. If you'd like to join the conversation, although we're getting short on time, we're at 549-2937, 549-2937, and we have a number of phone calls. So I'm going to go to Alicia, who's been waiting very patiently. Alicia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually just went vegan recently, and I've been really surprised to find out the environmental impact that our diets have. For instance, I think it produces, or to produce 1 pound of beef, it requires somewhere between 100 and 200 times more water than it does to produce a pound of vegetables. And then I also read somewhere that the United Nations said that livestock production is one of the biggest, or maybe even the biggest polluter of our water supply. So I just love to hear your comments on, the effects of a vegetarian or vegan diet.
Alicia, thank you very much for your comment. And Mr. Workmashi, this sort of repeated theme we've seen today on these consequences and the interrelationship and complexity of these challenges. Any comments?
Well, I think, I mean, several of the callers have just demonstrated incredible stewardship on their own. And what I feel is that Alicia or Kate and others that have been voluntarily taking these decisions are doing the right thing. I certainly approve. It's better than I think I'm doing myself. But I want to make sure that they are, you know, getting some gain from this. That that by doing so, somebody else doesn't just say, "Oh, cool. Well, then I can order the Big Mac and because she doesn't need that water, I will." And I, you know, it's a funny kind of way to perceive it, but that's what's happening worldwide and nationwide. And Dr. White referred to that Jacksonville doesn't want to put some strains on how much water can be withdrawn or how much people pay for their water, because then Atlanta or Jackson Atlanta or Orlando will say, "Oh yeah, well, we'll give you the water for free. Come set up your business here, build your homes here." And that's the trouble, really, for me with water, is that it, as it is now, where there's no sense of dominion, no sense of ownership, it pits consumer against producer, neighbor against neighbor, Jacksonville against Orlando, Florida against Georgia, and America against Mexico. And that's where we need to get it. How do we define whose water it is?
Well, for both our guests, let me ask you this. Do you think it's going to take a near-term crisis to actually change behavior? And the reason I say that is in the public policy arena, typically, whether it's the national debt or so many things, if the crisis is a long way away, it tends to be treated as no crisis at all. But if it's an immediate crisis, sometimes and oftentimes the crisis will result in a change in behavior. And on the water issues in particular, is it going to take a crisis to truly change behavior, Mr. Workman?
Yeah, I think, and not just a one crisis, I think a steady, maintained crisis that brings about these long-term shifts. In California, where I come from, every few years, they say, "Oh, we've had 3 years of drought now, and it's really not looking good." And you need to get to the point where you say, okay, instead of 3 years of drought and 1 year of normal, that you have 3 years of normal and 1 year of flooding, you start saying, okay, this is the new norm. We need to totally change our sense of what we pay, how we value. And places like Australia, they've had a 1,000-year drought. They've been able to cross that threshold. But you got to maintain it afterwards, and that's where the institutional changes come in.
Well, thank you. Now, Sonia, you have been waiting patiently, and you're going to be our last call for the day. We have some other people listening on the line. I'm so sorry. We've had a very full program. Sonia, thank you for calling. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. My question was, and I understand that we all need to be good stewards of our water and our environment, but my question is, why put it all on the individual? We have agribusiness, we have agricultural waste, and other businesses that are wasting water. So it kind of undoes whatever you can do as an individual citizen when you go and you see that water's being, you know, sprayed on the fields or being, you know, evaporating when it's being sprayed at the wrong times, or when you drive around Jacksonville and you see sprinklers watering the road, you know, at 3 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So, you know, I would like to know about that. And also, what about the existing enforcement of water restriction regulations? You know, who's enforcing those that were put into place? Or have there been any fines or anything when you see these businesses that are, you know, doing watering at the wrong times?
Sonia, thank you for your question. Dr. White, any comments?
I agree with her. It's it gets frustrating, but at the same time, I think we're looking for a society change. It's not just, I guess, us versus commercial guys. In fact, some of our larger corporations are doing a very, very good job of looking at water conservation. You think about some of the large bottling companies, and I'm not talking about bottling water. I'm talking about bottling beer, soda, what have you. PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, Budweiser have been leaders in reducing the amount of water used for certain things. But again, I think people, society, and you know, we're all in this collectively together. And it's going to take a societal change that will put pressure on corporations to use less water.
Mr. Workman, we want to We're short on time. You're going to have the final. First of all, we want to thank you here in Jacksonville for being here. We appreciate having you here. Any concluding comments for today on a very robust discussion?
Well, it's this is called Policy Matters, and I think there is definitely it raises the question, where does the government versus the individual versus the corporations come in? And I think government is excellent at setting collective goals and saying, let's focus on the outcome. We're going to get more water flowing down the St. John's. We're going to get more aquifers coming to the surface. We're going to make sure the water quality is at this level. Now, how we get there is up to our residents. It's up to our businesses. And by setting, that cap and allowing people to have a sense of ownership, of trading what they save, I think we can get there in a very fast and effective and non-contentious manner.
Mr. Workman, I want to thank you very, very much for being in Jacksonville and for your comments here today for the show and for your presentations today at Jacksonville University and UNF with the World Affairs Council. Dr. White, as always, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you again to our guests and callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and this has been Policy Matters on WJCT. Melissa Ross and First Coast Connect will be back tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time.